And we'll move on to our next case of the morning, which is case number 082558, United States versus Overtis Sykes, who the record should reflect is no relation to me.
I was going to ask that question. Not even a distant cousin?
No. We have a division of time for the defendants.
Yes, sir. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Kemp, and together with Jessica Frog, I represent Mr. Overtis Sykes under a 7-Eleven license for the Northwestern University School of Law. We ask this court to vacate or reverse Mr. Sykes' conviction for three reasons. First, there was a very serious violation of the Speedy Trial Act in this case, and the district court abused its discretion in dismissing the indictment without prejudice rather than with prejudice. Second, at trial, the district court erred in allowing the jurors to literally blurt out questions directly to the witnesses. And finally, the government denied Mr. Sykes his constitutional right to meaningfully access the courts in the critical 6 weeks leading up to his trial. Now, the speedy trial clock ran for at least 224 days in this case. That is three times the legal limit, and it's months longer than any other case that this court has ever considered. The first problem with the district court's remedy analysis under the Act was its presumption that the default remedy under the Act should be dismissal without prejudice. There is no such presumption anywhere within the statutory language, nor within any opinion of this court or the Supreme Court. Moreover,
that clearly was an error, but why was it not harmless under the circumstances here because of the comprehensiveness of the judge's decision on whether the dismissal should be with prejudice or without prejudice?
I think there were a couple other problems with the judge's analysis of the remedy. The judge counted the 224-day delay against Mr. Sykes. The blame for the entire delay lies wholly at the feet of the government. Mr. Sykes' actions were responsible for not a single one of those 224-day delays, and yet the district court erroneously attributed the length of the delay to Mr. Sykes by ruling that his so-called lassitude with respect to the Speedy Trial Act counseled in favor of dismissal without prejudice. But it is clearly the government's responsibility to bring cases to trial in a swift manner. And so counting the length of the delay against a criminal defendant is incorrect. And moreover, the judge completely failed to consider the prejudice to Mr. Sykes as inherent in such an extreme delay. A drain on a defendant's financial resources, the stigma of having an untried criminal indictment hanging over a defendant's head, the burden on his liberty, all increase as the length of the delay increases, as does the presumptive prejudice to the defendant's defense. I'd like to turn to our second claim regarding juror questions. The fact that the district court completely failed to weigh the costs and benefits of allowing juror questions in this case by itself constitutes plain error. Such balancing is required by this court's decision in U.S. v. Feinberg, and the record is simply devoid of any indication that the judge engaged in the requisite balancing. And even if the judge had engaged in such balancing, the decision to allow juror questions in these circumstances when a pro se defendant is not present cannot be correct. Juror questions
the
in
these... The question seemed... didn't they seem fairly harmless? Would you agree with that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. One, the questions prejudiced Mr. Sykes in two very, very clear ways here. The first form of prejudice was that one juror asked the judge, does the defendant not have a defense? The judge responded that, quote, that Mr. Sykes was representing himself, and that, quote, Mr. Sykes takes the position, for reasons I won't go into, that this court has no jurisdiction over him, and this is certainly one reason he's decided to waive his presence, end quote. That's judicial testimony about Mr. Sykes' pretrial legal positions that never would have come out at trial absent the juror questions and absent the judge's inappropriate response
to
that question.
It wouldn't have come out absent the juror's question because the defendant would have been there.
Well, Mr. Sykes declined to attend his trial because he thought that he was not going to get a fair trial.
He still maintained his position that there was no jurisdiction. He hadn't abandoned that just from his pretrial position, had he?
But it's certainly unclear that would have come out at trial. In fact, the district court had made some comments earlier in the proceedings that he wasn't going to allow Mr. Sykes to talk about his positions. And I think bringing that out sort of implies that Mr. Sykes doesn't have an actual defense to these charges. And the second form of prejudice from the juror questions was that they essentially allowed the government. Help the government meet its burden of proof by alerting the government to gaps in its case. Essentially, the government was able to get a sneak peek into the jurors' deliberations. They could see what doubts the jurors had about the evidence, and then they were able to elicit additional testimony from the witnesses, ask follow-up questions. And Mr. Sykes, of course, had no opportunity to do this.
So should the rule be that questions may never be allowed in criminal cases?
I think the rule should be the questions should never be allowed if only the prosecution is present and there's no defense. I think the prejudice in those circumstances is inherent in allowing only one side to follow up on those questions and to fill in evidentiary gaps in the case. The jurors asked 37 questions in this case over what was essentially one full day of testimony.
Isn't the real problem here that the judge didn't screen the questions first?
That's certainly
not the fact that the jury was permitted to ask questions, but that the judge didn't screen them in advance.
That certainly compounded the error, Your Honor. I think if the judge had screened the questions, perhaps the question about Mr. Sykes' defense would not have come out, and the jurors would not have engaged in these sort of deliberations, expressing opinions about the evidence and alerting their fellow jurors to what they thought the gaps in the evidence were. I think the jurors asked 21 questions about the fingerprint analysis alone. I think that in itself lays bare the fact that they had a lot of doubts about this case and that the government's case was not actually as strong as the government's brief represents.
How is the in-court ID made without the defendant there?
Well, that's part of the problem, Your Honor. There was no in-court ID. There were eyewitnesses from the banks. There were only lineup identifications from two of the banks, not from the other two that were charged. And I think that sort of highlighted the importance of the fingerprint evidence. That was the physical thread that tied Mr. Sykes and his co-defendant to all the bank robberies. And the jurors had a lot of doubts about it. They asked 21 questions about it.
Well, I assume there was some law enforcement testimony linking the identifications made in the lineup to the defendant, right?
There was, Your Honor, yes. Yes.
The fact that they asked 21 questions about fingerprints, which you say expressed doubt, doesn't that help your client?
Not when only one side is there to bolster its case.
So is your real complaint that your client was not at trial?
My real complaint is that juror questions should not be allowed when only one side is there to follow up on those questions.
I guess what I'm getting at is your client made it very difficult to get this case to trial.
He did file a number of unorthodox motions, Your Honor, yes. I think the only
And his lack of presence could have been strategic so that he wouldn't be identified.
I think that's probably far-fetched, and there's no indication in the record that's the case. I think
I'll grant you there's probably no indication in the record, but I don't think it's so far-fetched.
I think the only effect that Mr. Sykes' absence has on this court's review of this case is that we're working under a plain error standard. He didn't object to the practice. We certainly acknowledge that, and so we have to reverse for plain error. I see I'm into rebuttal time. I'd like to briefly address the meaningful access to the court's argument. Mr. Sykes was left in the 6 weeks leading up to his trial without any mode of accessing the courts. He could not contact a standby counsel. His standby counsel could not even locate him. He had no access to a law library. And this is a violation of his right to meaningfully access the courts. Now, the government has the choice of how to provide that access, of what mode they're going to provide, but they have to provide some mode to a pro se defendant. It did not provide any mode whatsoever in this case.
And what other motions did he want to make that he hadn't already made, or what defenses was he deprived because of this?
Well, I think if Mr. Sykes had some access to legal research materials, he might have been able to make some motions in limine regarding the evidence that would come out at trial. He simply had no access at all to legal research materials, either through his standby counsel or through the library or through any other means.
He had that access for months and months prior to this six-week period when he was housed at, I can't remember which prison he was housed at.
Kankakee. He was at the MCC previously, and then he was moved to Kankakee.
So at his prior location, he had law library access, I take it, and access to a standby counsel.
Clear from the record that he utilized that law library access.
True.
The problem was in the critical 6 weeks leading up to his trial, when the rubber really meets the road, he did not have that access. That should be deemed a structural error, and it requires reversal. And I would like to reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grimes.
May it please the Court, Steve Grimes on behalf of the United States. I'd like to address the three issues raised by defendant here. First, the court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing this indictment without prejudice. The court, on December 20th, went through a thorough analysis of the 3162A2 factors. The court began by looking at the seriousness of the offense as it was required to do by the statute and by this court's precedent. The court noted that this was a very serious offense, four bank robberies over the course of 11 days in which defendant threatened tellers by saying that he had a gun and making a specific threat of violence, that they had 15 seconds to respond. The court noted that this was a very serious offense, as it was required to do, and then went on to the next factor, which is laid out by statute, and looking at the facts and the circumstances of the offense. The court specifically found on the record on December 20th that the government was not to blame for any of the delays that were at issue, that there was no bad faith on the part of the government. And looking here, it's necessary to look at some of the underlying days which defendant says were not properly excluded. And I'd like to focus on the period from January 25th, 2007 through May 8th, 2007, in which the district court made an explicit finding that period of time would be excluded in order to allow for plea negotiations. On appeal, the defendant has argued that was an improper exclusion because there was some contradictory evidence in the record as to whether plea negotiations were actually going on during that period. But there is indications in the record that the defense and the government were working towards a resolution, a plea agreement, during that time period. Based on that information, the judge found on the record that time was excludable. That's a period of 103 days. Similarly, there is evidence in the record supporting the judge's finding that a period of 112 days was properly excluded in order for pretrial preparations to be held. The third factor that the court considered specifically on the record was the prejudice to the defendant. In this case, and on appeal, defendant has argued that the prejudice that he suffered is that he was incarcerated pretrial. This court has specifically found that is not the primary focus, nor is it an explicit factor that this court is to consider in determining the prejudice under 3162A. This court's decision was in United States v. Killingsworth. That is the only harm here that defendant argues resulted from this extensive pretrial delay. The district court also specifically considered the public interest and the interest in resolving this case and how the harm to defendant would be balanced against the public interest in re-prosecution. And the district court specifically said that it would be a gross miscarriage of justice in order to allow a dismissal with prejudice in this case with such a serious offense and with such minimal harm to the defendant. The court specifically relied on the United States v. Killingsworth decision. The district court said on the record a number of times that it had recently reviewed that decision. And with respect to the argument that the district court applied a presumption in favor of dismissal without prejudice, I don't believe that's supported by the record. The district court was following the teachings of Killingsworth, in which this court said that a violation of the Speedy Trial Act alone is not enough to warrant dismissal with prejudice. The court at that time stated that it just read the Killingsworth case. The court was very familiar with the proceedings up to that point, had heard arguments as to the number of days which should be or should not be excluded, and had heard partial argument from both sides as to whether this dismissal should be with or without prejudice when it made the statement that a strong argument by defendant would be needed in order to dismiss with prejudice. As to the second claim that defense makes here on appeal, that actually the third argument they made here on appeal, the second one that they raised in their brief, is that defendant was denied meaningful access to the courts because for the 5 or 6 week period that he was detained at Kankakee Jail, that he did not have access to law, to a law library or to a standby counsel. That argument is both legally and factually wrong. This court has specifically held that if a defendant is offered the assistance of counsel in the form of a public defender and rejects that offer, that he is not entitled to anything more. In this case, defendant was offered the assistance of counsel. He rejected it. And in addition to that, he rejected on a number of occasions the assistance of his standby counsel. This line of cases has been applied by this circuit to both a Fifth Amendment argument as well as a Sixth Amendment argument, and it applies squarely to this set of facts before us. In addition, Mr. Sykes, 6 days before he was set to go to trial, brought this issue to the district court's attention. He argued that his Fifth Amendment right to meaningful access to the courts had been denied that because he was unable to meet with his counsel. The district court asked him if he would like a continuance of the trial in order to remedy that situation, and the defendant said no, he would not. Finally, the third issue that's been raised on appeal was the district court's decision to allow, to allow the jurors to directly ask questions of the government's witnesses. The district court did not commit plain error in doing so. On the record, the district court stated that because the defendant was not present, he was going to permit this practice. I think from that we can reasonably infer that the district court believed that allowing the jurors to ask questions would in some way level the playing field because defendant was not there and his defense counsel was not there. It appears that defendant's main argument on appeal is that he was somehow harmed from this practice because the practice in itself is fraught with risk. But if you look at defendant's arguments, he doesn't actually make an argument of prejudice. There was no prejudice here. There's no argument that the questions themselves that were asked by the jurors were improper or that they somehow elicited improper testimony. The argument is that they allowed the witnesses to further explain the case or further explain the evidence that went eventually towards a guilty verdict.
Does Judge Grady ordinarily allow questions by jurors in criminal cases?
Not to my knowledge, although I'm not familiar with his general practices. So if you look at the actual harm here, there is none. What happened, and it's a fortunate outcome because Judge Grady did not implement the safeguards that we would, particularly hope that the judge would implement if they do permit juror questions. But fortunately, there was no harm here. The only thing that happened was that the jurors were able to elicit testimony which clarified prior testimony and which further supported, the search for the truth.
Did you prosecute this case?
I did not, Judge.
Well, do you know whether there was a suggestion made that the judge should screen the questions rather than engaging in this free-form have-at-it jurors? That's highly unorthodox.
There is no suggestion in the record, and to my knowledge, that was not done.
It wasn't done. I was asking whether there was any suggestion that the judge should screen the questions if he was going to permit this procedure. Apparently that was not done.
Not to my knowledge. The government would certainly concede that this is not the best practice and that if questions are going to be permitted, there should be safeguards in place.
Actually, our cases say that.
Right. And we concede that, but we are very fortunate in that there was no prejudice here that resulted from this. And for those reasons, unless there are further questions, I would ask that this court affirm.
Well, it is especially difficult when, from the prosecutor's perspective, I'm sure, when you're prosecuting someone with no defense lawyer, you really need to be careful not to let things happen that shouldn't happen because the defendant's not present. There's nothing wrong with suggesting to the judge, wait a minute, maybe before you do that, these things should be screened.
Yes, we agree with that. And it wasn't done in this particular case, but we certainly agree with that practice. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it Ms. Froge?
May it please the court. The government essentially raises two issues about juror questions. One is about the weighing, and the second is about the prejudice to the defendant. Turning first to the weighing, this court held in Feinberg that the district court is obligated to engage in that weighing, and there's no sign that that occurred here. The idea that the invitation to the jurors was the weighing is just incorrect. And even if the district court was trying to level the playing field in some way, that reason, although well-intentioned, is still the wrong decision. As for the second argument, that there was no prejudice to the defendant, there was prejudice to the defendant, and it came in two forms. First, on the issue of fingerprint testimony, those questions elicited not only clarifying points, but gave the prosecution a sneak peek into reasonable doubts and allowed the prosecution to engage in one-sided bolstering.
Is there any indication that if the case were reversed, that the defendant would participate in the trial or would he remain in his tent waiting for something to fall?
Throughout the entire process up to the trial, it appeared that he wanted to present a defense, and he was a very active pro se defendant.
All he had to do was show up to present a defense.
Yes, but in those weeks prior to trial, he was unable to prepare a defense.
You're missing my question, however, at this stage of the game. Is there any indication, if the case were reversed, that he would clamor to get into the courtroom? As he was given the invitation to come to the courtroom this time.
Yes, I think that if he was given...
Well, he did not. Well, let me finish my thought. Is there any indication, any place in the record, that if the case were reversed, that he had another crack at it, that he'd leap to the barricades and start propounding his defense, or would he just take the position the court had no jurisdiction anyway?
I think that given the fact that he was such an active pro se defendant, that he wanted to be present at trial.
He was such an active pro se defendant, he didn't even show up for his trial. So that is not exactly what you might call zealous defense work. I want to know if there's anything in the record. Has he said anything to you or anyone else that indicates he wants his chance to rush in and present a defense?
We have not asked him that, and there's nothing in the record.
So there is no indication that he would do anything except what he did before, and that's not come to court.
No, I don't think that that's true. I think that he didn't come to court because he felt that he had no ability to prepare a defense. If the circumstances were changed, I think that he would prepare a defense and vigorously defend himself before the jury. He really wanted to go to trial. That's evident throughout this entire long march up to the trial.
Well, I didn't see any great indication of his deep desire to leap to trial. But maybe I missed it. I'll go back and look again.
Turning to the other form of prejudice, the juror questioned, does the defendant not have a defense, elicited prejudicial judicial testimony from the presiding judge. The judge commented on the defendant's absence from trial, his theory of defense, and other things that he observed prior to trial. Turning next to the Speedy Trial Act issue, there's two points that need clarification. First, the government contends that the district court reached the correct decision, but two of the three factors here weigh in favor of dismissal with prejudice. This is a very serious offense, but this is also a very serious violation of the Speedy Trial Act, 224 days. Indeed, the district court's failure to calculate cannot be construed as a comprehensive analysis of the issue. If the court had so much calculated the length of delay, it would have seen that this suggested a prejudice, an actual prejudice to the defendant's defense, which was actually borne out later when he was unable to contact alibi witnesses and was drained of financial resources. Although the government contends there was no bad faith on the part of the government, even if this delay was unintentional, it was nevertheless negligent, and all of the delay is wholly attributable to the government. It is entirely at their feet, and it is entirely their obligation to bring this to trial within 70 days. Second, they attempt to reduce the length of the delay, challenging some periods of exclusion. The plea negotiations and trial preparations were improperly excluded because there was nothing in the record to suggest that plea negotiations were ongoing or that there was any need for lengthy trial preparation. As for the administration of justice on this act, it would be a gross miscarriage of justice to allow the government to escape this egregious violation of the Speedy Trial Act. And finally, turning to the issue of meaningful access to the courts, the government contends that all the government needed to do to satisfy its obligation in this case was to offer appointed counsel. But this confuses the issue. The right of representation and the right to proceed pro se are two separate and, the right to meaningful access to the courts are two separate and distinct rights. When a defendant chooses to exercise his right to proceed pro se, that's not a rejection of the right of representation. It's a decision to exercise one right, and they don't lose their right of meaningful access to the courts in that process. This is consistent with all of the cases cited by the government. In all of those cases, the defendant wanted a particular mode of access, such as a law library or particular counsel, but they always had at least one mode of meaningful access to the courts, standby counsel. That's not what happened here. The defendant had no ability to access standby counsel in those critical 6 weeks before trial. Furthermore, the district court's offer of a continuance wouldn't have resolved anything because he essentially offered the same status quo, the same standby counsel, and the same circumstances where the defendant had been unable to contact his standby counsel. For these reasons, we ask that you vacate the conviction and dismiss with prejudice or remand for a new trial.
All right. Thank you very much. Our thanks to all counsel, and especially our thanks to Ms. Frog and Mr. Kemp and the Northwestern Law School Clinic for accepting this appointment and for your vigorous representation on behalf of your client. Thank you.
Amen.